Call to order. I would like to welcome you all to the Board of Directors meeting for the Altus Schools of San Diego Nonprofit Board, which operates our Rodeo Charter School and the Charter School of San Diego. I am Len Herring, Chairman of the Board, and will facilitate the meeting. First, let's take a roll call. When I call your name, please, we don't need to do any of that this morning. Myself, present, Scott.
Present.
David. David Green.
He's excused.
Okay. Tim Morton.
Present.
Outstanding. And Eric Schweinfurter.
Present.
Okay. All present. We do have a quorum. Do I have a motion to establish a quorum?
So moved, Martin.
Well, and a
Second,
second.
Morton.
Thank you. Conduct a vote for the roll call. Myself, I, Scott.
Aye.
David is excused. Tim.
Aye.
And Eric.
Aye.
Motion passes. I will now ask that everyone rise for Pledge of Allegiance. Well, I pledge of allegiance to the flag of the United
States of America. And to
to
the
the
Republic,
Republic, which
for which
stands
it stands,
one
one
nation,
people,
under
under
God,
God,
indivisible,
indivisible,
with
with
liberty
liberty
and
and
justice
justice for all.
Okay. All right. We don't have an agenda, correct, other than this meeting. For master,
we just have the agenda and the one item, which is the board training. So,
okay. So the agenda is the board training that we'll receive this morning. Do I have a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved, Morton.
You have a second?
Second, Martin.
Very well. Now vote the roll call. Myself, aye. Scott.
Aye.
David's excused. Tim?
Aye.
And Eric?
Aye.
Okay. We don't have to go through public comment or anything, do we?
You have public comment on today's agenda for non-agenda and agenda items.
Okay. So we'll read through public comment for items of interest to the public within the scope of the Altus Schools. San Diego non-agenda shall be no longer than 2 minutes. Public comment for agenda items shall be no longer than 3 minutes. Speakers may not yield their time in meeting held over Zoom. Any person who wishes to make a comment with the agenda or non-agenda items shall use the raise hand feature of Zoom to notify the board. In accordance with the Brown Act, no discussion or action may occur at this time, but it is the board's prerogative to respond or give direction to the staff. All public comment will be heard at this point in the agenda as ordered below. Each agenda item being commented on will have a maximum of 20 minutes allotted, and each non-agenda item will have a maximum of 10 minutes allotted. If necessary, I may equivocally decrease the time for each speaker in order to stay within the allotted time. 2.1 is non-agenda public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items not on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 2 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes in total, unless otherwise modified by myself. Speakers may not yield their time. Are there any public comments on items not on the agenda? Hearing none and seeing no raised hands, we'll move on to item 2.2, agenda public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items that appear on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Speakers may not yield their time. Are there any public comments on agenda items? Hearing none and seeing no raised hands, we'll move on to agenda 3.0, which is consent agenda, which is basically this effort here. So all matters listed under the consent agenda And there are no matters under the consent agenda, correct? Okay, so we'll move on. I guess, are we going to do this in closed session or is this open session? Open session?
Yep.
Very good. Then moving on to the next, and that is agenda. And I guess at this point, Paul, the floor is yours.
Good morning, everyone. Happy November 1st. It's hard to believe sometimes. Hope everybody had a great holiday last night. Some fun with friends, at least. But we're going to take up probably about an hour and a half or plus or minus an hour and a half this morning, talking a little bit about the first part of a two-part workshop that my colleague, Senior Counsel Kayla Hady, is going to take the first part this morning and go through the Brown Act and conflicts of interest training in the second part, which will happen on November 13th, about, I think, at the same time, will be board governance, best practices, fiduciary oversight, fiscal oversight, and a review of the ever-changing landscape of education law with critical updates on new laws and new cases, critical cases that are going out down the state of California. As many of you know, by reading the papers, there's a lot of high-level public policy issues that are being played out of public schools, including on the legislative and case law front. So anyway, without further ado, I will introduce you to Kayla Hady. She's going to take the first part of the slides this morning and go through the Brown Act on the conflict of interest training. And then I will see you back on November 13th, where we'll get board governance best practices and the critical laws updated. So we are recording. We will be distributing the recording, and we'll be also distributing the PowerPoint presentation after as well. And we've got plenty of time to be able to answer questions as we go through the training as well. Kayla.
All right. Good morning, everyone. How are you doing? So we're going to start, as Paul said, we're going to start today with the Brown Act and conflict of interest. So this will ultimately be an incredibly comprehensive training where we also discuss best practices and board policies and many new laws and incredibly interesting cases that are in this landscape. But for today, we'll start at the beginning, which is the Brown Act and the conflict of interest. A few disclaimers before we get going. First, we are in open session. And so because of that, this training is not personalized legal advice. We don't enjoy the same attorney-client privilege that we would if we were just talking one-on-one. So keep that in mind with any questions, which we're of course happy to answer. Number two, our advice is based on the latest available guidance. It's ever-changing. You'll see some new laws even in the presentation today, even one that was just chaptered in October. So cutting edge stuff here in the Brown Act and conflict of interest realm. And then after the training, but also during the training, feel free to ask any questions. Just, you know, because we're in open session, keep that in mind. Our firm mission, we champion outstanding choices in education for all students. We believe that quality education is a civic right, and we work and fight alongside you to ensure students' needs are always put first. A number of attorneys at my firm used to be teachers before becoming attorneys, myself included. I spent 4 years as a fifth grade teacher before going to law school and taught at a charter school. So the good work that you all are doing really matters to us on both a personal and a professional level. So we're excited. We're excited to help any way that we can. That's me and Paul, of course. And then we kind of already went over this agenda. Today we'll do Brown Act conflict of interest. And then when we come back on the 13th, and Paul will present on board best practices, and we'll get into some new laws and critical case updates. All right, let's dig into the Brown Act. So first we're gonna just go quick overview. We're gonna be answering these six questions during the training. The first, what's the purpose of the act? Of course, understanding why the act exists and why it was implemented helps contextualize all of its various provisions and can just generally lead to a better understanding of the act's many, many nuances, some of which, as I mentioned, are new, very new. The second, what constitutes a meeting? This one is important too, is understanding what qualifies as a meeting enables you to understand when you actually have to follow the act legal requirements. Third, what are the meeting notice and agenda requirements? Fourth, what are the public's rights at meetings? Spoiler alert, they have many rights. But fifth, there are, of course, closed sessions where we can limit the public's access. And then finally, we are going to round out with a discussion of penalties and remedies for violating the act in the event that something does happen. All right, so question one, what is the purpose? The very broad purpose of the act is just to foster broad public access. Give the people, the public, access to your meetings. The Brown Act is one of those laws that's in the spirit of sunshine and public transparency. And I always think that it's helpful to think about that fundamental purpose here when we're determining what we can and cannot do in a meeting. The bottom line, this is the official language as we have quoted here as the purpose of the act, but the bottom line is to allow the public to have access to your meetings and some input, though limited, into the decisions you make. So the Brown Act essentially provides this mechanism by which members of the public know what you're planning to discuss and can participate, again, in limited ways about the conversations that you're having at those meetings. But at the same time, as you all know, that public access is not absolute. So something to think about in structuring your meetings and agendas is where those nuances lie. So you can determine where confidentiality is allowed or even required, despite this general scheme and presumption around public transparency. So there are, of course, these closed sessions that allow for confidential meetings of the board that are not subject to public access. This is a snapshot list. We'll discuss these a few times throughout the training today, but generally personnel matters, labor negotiations, real property negotiations, advice from your legal counsel, which generally comes with either anticipated litigation and you think that a lawsuit's forthcoming or you are potentially going to initiate a lawsuit or you're engaged in a current dispute. Then we also have public security and people discipline. Outside of these areas, you can assume that public interest is required and that that conversation that you're having is not subject to closed session. Okay, how does the Brown Act accomplish its purpose? Generally, as we know, its purpose is to foster this broad public access, shine a light on the board and the ongoings of the school. So how is that actually accomplished? First, public is given notice of meetings. We have the agenda posting requirements, which we'll detail in a bit. We also, the meetings have to be open to the public. Confidentiality is limited to those closed sessions, and those closed sessions are statutorily authorized. The vast majority of them come from the government code itself and the Brown Act section itself. There is one, the pupil discipline one, that comes from actually the education code, but they're all authorized by statute. Transparency, however, does not mean chaos. Although our meetings are held in public, they are not controlled by the public. And we have a new law that I think actually was in effect at the time or was coming into effect at the time that we gave our board training last year, but about public disruption. And the charter school can, of course, set more stringent requirements to foster greater access, greater participation. They can choose, for example, to do longer posting periods, but you can't do less than the law requires. So we always recommend checking charter, bylaws, MOUs. Some school districts, some authorizers require more stringent requirements. That's not the case here, however. All right, so what constitutes a board meeting? We have this basic definition. A meeting occurs when any congregation of the majority of the members of the body meet to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action. That portion is underlined because that's statutory language on any item of school business. However, there are some exceptions to that. Certainly, a majority of you can attend a public conference of general interest. We have the Charter School Development Center conference coming up in just a little bit over a week. A majority of you all could absolutely go to that. A majority of the board members can also attend another body's public meeting. We see that really often if your charter is up for renewal. A majority of board members might show up at your school, at a school district board meeting or county district board meeting to support your school and see that board's discussion of your school and its renewal. And if you make public comment at that meeting, which you're absolutely authorized to do, the idea is that that meeting has to be public. That meeting has to follow the Brown Act because it's also a public entity, a public body. So you are still meeting that transparency threshold. And then you can also attend purely social or ceremonial gatherings like graduation or award ceremonies. The caveat with all of these being that school business is not discussed. So if, for example, a majority of the board was attending your authorizer's school board meeting, what you would want to be careful to do is not have a conversation in the parking lot following that meeting, debriefing how you think it went, how the board reacted, et cetera, because that could very readily constitute a meeting if you have the majority of you all. What about committees? This is an area that it causes a lot of confusion. We get a lot of client questions about this. As a general rule, committees do have to follow the Brown Act. And there are some limited exceptions, which we'll talk about in a second, but it doesn't matter. This is true, even if it's just a temporary committee, even if it's just an advisory committee. And so a lot of charter schools, a lot of schools in general, fail to understand the nuances of committees and how that can actually still constitute a meeting that needs to require Brown Act posting requirements. Everything that would be required of the larger board would be required of most committees. There are, so a standing committee, meaning a committee that is going for a number of times on a specific topic. We often see like budget or finance committees or facilities committee. A standing committee have to follow the Brown Act, even if it's advisory, as we kind of just talked about. And even if it is composed of members that are less than a quorum. So, and how you know that a committee is a standing committee is if it has continuing subject matter jurisdiction, or it has a meeting schedule that is fixed by charter, ordinance, resolution, or board's formal action. So if you all take action that you are going to have a committee on charter renewal and you've taken action on that, that could potentially be a standing committee, even if they're only operating for a limited amount of time, you know, for their 3 months prior to the charter renewal submission or something along those lines. And like I said, it does not matter if it's less than a quorum. And it also doesn't matter if you just have a couple of board members and you have a parent or another community member as part of that committee as well. So the general rule, as I said, committees have to follow the Brown Act. Everything that you all would have to do as a larger board, committees would have to do as their smaller entity. There are some limited exceptions to when committees do not have to follow the Brown Act. The one exception for certain advisory committees is that a committee is not subject to the Brown Act if it's only advisory, it's composed solely of members of the board. So as soon as you get a parent or you get a community member on there, this would not apply. It's less than a quorum of the board and it's not a standing committee. So they're not talking about something, a certain topic over a period of time, like the Finance Committee, Facilities Committee. It's not a committee that the board has taken action to create. Then potentially they could not follow the Brown Act. But again, it's limited exceptions and it causes a lot of confusion for clients. So We should recommend caution and carefulness there. Okay, let's talk about serial meetings. Serial meetings are prohibited under the Brown Act because they are essentially the exact opposite of what you're supposed to be doing as a legislative body. We just this week, just yesterday, I ran into an issue with a client on this. And basically what was going on is the board members were discussing board school business in an email. They were going back and forth. There was some consternation between the administration and the board members were discussing that over email, and there was a huge chain. So, you know, that's incredibly problematic. That is a serial meeting. Serial meetings, the definition is, it's a majority of the board members. So in the case that happened just yesterday, a majority of the board members were not actually participating in the discussion, but two board members were going back and forth over this email chain. And all of the other board members were copied on the exchange. So that would absolutely be prohibited under the Brown Act. It also is outside a meeting, just by virtue of it being a serial meeting. Using a series of communications of any kind, directly or through intermediaries, to discuss, deliberate, or take action, that's that same language that we saw at the beginning, that statutory language about what constitutes a meeting, on any item of school business that's within the subject matter jurisdiction of the body, and anything that school business is essentially going to be within your subject matter jurisdiction. So you can't do this. It's very prohibited. Be careful. Where we see this come up most often is, like I said, email chains, times you might not expect. There's other, you know, texts, social media, website postings. They can very quickly devolve into a meeting that would need to be required following the Brown Act, which, you know, in the case of that email chain, it absolutely was not. So there's also this limit on unilateral communications. While an employer or official may engage in separate conversations or communications outside of a meeting with other members of the board in order to answer questions or provide information regarding charter school business, that person may not communicate to members of the board the comments or position of other members of the board. That's just kind of common sense. If you all have a question of staff and you ask staff, you ask your administration a question, one board member would go to the administration and ask their question. The administration would, of course, know then not to share your opinion with another board member, because that would constitute just using them as an intermediary. And it would be sharing communications about school business outside of a sanctioned board meeting. Okay, with all of this in mind, I am going to switch focus to discuss virtual meetings, which I remember discussing last year as well. So none of this should be completely shocking. It has become just a wild world. And the legislator this session made some efforts to make it easier to appear remotely, but what actually passed was not very helpful at all. So I'll talk about that in a second. But generally, in terms of most teleconferences, this is the area that we received in the last year, since about February, when the state of emergency ended. We have received countless questions about this. I just got an email in my inbox this morning about a board meeting that had taken place last month, and the board, not a quorum, had participated in the jurisdiction. And so there were a lot of questions come up. This is something that we see a lot. So these right here are the standard teleconference meeting rules. They have been in the Brown Act for years and years and years. And they're still a good law. It was developed pre-COVID, pre-virtual, pre-this remote era. And though it's more onerous than the rules that we enjoyed under the COVID era, it is still in effect. So if you want to follow these requirements for teleconferencing, you can, you may, and you would absolutely be in compliance. So these are just the six additional requirements that you have to take if you are going to appear remotely under these traditional standard teleconference meeting rule. First, the agenda has to be posted at all teleconference locations. So this means that if you are teleconferencing in from a hotel or your home, you have to post the agenda at the hotel. And also vitally, each specific teleconference location has to be posted. So if you are at your office or in your hotel room, you have to give the address of the hotel, but also the room number where you will be teleconferencing. The idea being that if a member of the public wanted to, they could come in to your room and join you in your meeting from your space where you are teleconferencing. Also, each teleconference location must be identified in the notice and agenda of that meeting. So you would list all of the various, if a couple of the board members were participating remotely, you would list all of the locations of the remote participants. And all votes have to be taken by roll call, and each teleconferencing location. So all votes have to be taken by roll call. And then separately from that, each teleconferencing location must be accessible to the public. This can be problematic, for example, if you are teleconferencing from the second story of your house, for example, and like most of us, you have stairs and not an elevator. That can be problematic under these rules, as they wouldn't be ADA compliant. Members of the public also must be able to hear and must have the right to address the board directly from each teleconference location. So that's what I was talking about before. That's why you have to put your room number if you're teleconferencing from a hotel or your very specific location, so that a member of the public could come find you and could participate with you in that location. And then finally, under these rules, a quorum of the board still has to participate from the charter school's jurisdiction, meaning the county or counties in which the charter school serves. Okay, those are the six normal rules. As I've said, they've been in the Brown Act for years and years. Then in March 2020, everything changed, of course. During the pandemic, Governor Newsom used his authority under the Emergency Services Act to waive most of those requirements through an executive order. And then we got a bill that allowed for virtual meetings. All of that has now expired. So what's left are these traditional teleconferencing rules, and then some new and pretty confusing laws that allow for additional virtual attendance. So when we gave our board training, when Paul and I gave our board training last year, this law was not yet in effect, but it was, I believe that we discussed it because it was already chaptered, it was already law, it just hadn't come into effect yet. But essentially, this is the new law, AB 2449. It's frankly a complicated bill. There are a lot of requirements to exercise the flexibility that the bill allows. So I understand the thought behind it, the idea behind it, but the onerousness of it kind of makes it less helpful than we would like. The first thing to keep in mind for this flexibility is that it's only allowed for personal emergencies and for just cause. So the statute helpfully expressly defines what those mean. So I'll go over that in a little bit, but know that either of those circumstances have to be present. When there is a personal emergency or a just cause, this bill allows the teleconferencing rules to be relaxed. So it allows, as we have here on the slide, it allows teleconferencing without any obligation to identify the teleconferencing location on the agenda or allow public access to the teleconferencing location. Interestingly, under this one, the board members have to participate through both audio and visual technology. So you cannot be taking it from your car and only be on audio. You have to be both. That is not true under the traditional standard teleconferencing rules, but it is true under AB 2449 and these exceptions for personal emergencies and for just cause. So helpfully, they do give us a definition. Emergency circumstance means a physical, or family medical emergency that prevents a member from attending in person. This is a vague, broad definition, which is great because then it allows for a wide variety of emergencies. It doesn't require hospitalization. It doesn't require any certain level of an emergency. It is purposely vague to allow for various circumstances. Then there's also just cause. So just cause is any of the following: child care or parental caregiving needs, child, parent, grandparent, grandchild, sibling, spouse, domestic partner, that would require you to participate remotely. A contagious illness that prevents the member from attending in person, a need related to a physical or mental disability that is defined in law and not otherwise accommodated, or travel while on official business of the governing board or of another state or local agency. So those are the four reasons that you could use this just cause. And outside of those, you know, this one is more specifically defined. Just cause would not apply. So teleconferencing based on emergency, not just cause. So there's emergency is defined broadly, which is great, but it does require a few extra steps that just cause does not require. So if you are going to teleconference based on emergency, you have to make the request to participate remotely as soon as possible. You would make that request to your board chair, and you would want to make that request as soon as you know that that emergency is occurring. The member also has to make a separate request for each meeting in which they're seeking to participate remotely. So that would mean that you can't just have a standing emergency for your next three meetings. At each meeting, you would have to request that. And then if the request does not allow sufficient time to place proposed action on the agenda, the board has to take action under this one. Then the board still can take action at the beginning of the meeting, even though it's not on the agenda. So, I mean, emergencies by definition, you're generally not going to know them too far in advance. It might not make it onto the agenda. And so but that's fine. It does not have to be on the agenda. The board at the beginning can still take action to say that you are participating remotely. You've made that request and the board is accepted. Just cause is limited. So the utility of these is not great because there are these limitations. So just cause can only be used twice per calendar year. So two times you can use just cause. The member must also request emergency circumstances and the board must vote to approve. That's what we just discussed. If they do it in time to get put on the agenda, you can have a limited agenda description. Of course, you would not want to explain a particular board member's familial circumstances if they're having a family emergency, but you could just say X board member is participating remotely due to an emergency. So that all is fine, but then there's also this global cap. So just cause can only be used twice a year. But for both just cause and emergency, they cannot be used for more than three consecutive months, more than 20% of the regular meetings within the calendar year, or more than two meetings if the board meets regularly, if the board regularly meets fewer than 10 times per year. So like I said, it just makes these caps make the utility of these difficult. Because they're really supposed to be for special circumstances and not for normal use. And then there are even other requirements. So even within these, at least a quorum of the board still has to participate from one single physical location. So that's different language than we have under the traditional teleconferencing rules, which just say that the quorum has to participate within the jurisdiction, meaning the county or counties that the school serves. This is the same physical location, and that location has to be clearly identified on the agenda, and the agenda, or, you know, that location has to be open to the public, situated within the jurisdiction. Members of the public must also be provided a means to remotely hear and visually observe the meeting and remotely address the governing board. So what we're suggesting there as best practice is, in the event that one of your board members does want to use this, the just cause or emergency exception. It essentially means, the second bullet point here, essentially means that you all have to put a Zoom link or a way for the public, or you know, some other video conferencing link, a way for the public to access the meeting remotely if any member wants to participate remotely. Now, for the emergency or the just cause, they might not know very, very far in advance. It might not make it onto the agenda for the emergency. So we're recommending as best practice, in case one of your board members does want to use this, put a Zoom link on every agenda, because that'll cover you if a board member does come and wants to use this. If a board member comes and wants to use this and the Zoom link or the ability to remote access is not posted on the agenda, then they are not able to participate under either of these, because you have to give the public access and a way to appear remotely, engage with the board remotely. The agenda also has, this is what I just was talking about, it's just an extension of it, has to provide notice of how members of the public can access the meeting, provide public comment, cannot require public comment submitted in advance. That's already a requirement. If the broadcast is disrupted, the board may not take action until that remote access to the meeting is restored. So if we have rolling blackouts or something happens that puts down the broadcast, then the board has to close up until broadcast is resumed. They cannot continue to hold their meeting. And then this is a weird requirement, which is not in the traditional teleconferencing rules, and the reason for which is pretty unclear to me. So if you are participating under just cause, or if you are participating under the emergency circumstance, and there is somebody who is 18 or older in the room with you, you have to tell the board and the public during the opening of the meeting who that person is and the general nature of your relationship with that person. So this one is the one that I was talking about, which was just chaptered in October. So it was just made law, very new. So as I said, this legislative session, we saw a lot of efforts by different legislators to try to increase teleconferencing flexibility. And we've had a number of boards who have gotten used to appearing remotely, like the convenience, you know, they work important jobs, and getting to a board meeting at X time, X day is a lot more difficult if they have to do so in person. We saw a lot of effort, however, not much came into fruition. So as we've discussed, the state of emergency expired in February. So board meetings have begun to felt that transition back to in-person. AB 557, it eliminates the sunset date. This is what was just chaptered. It eliminates the sunset date for local agencies to use teleconferencing without complying with traditional teleconferencing requirements during a, and this is the important part, a proclaimed state of emergency. So after March 2020, we had a state of emergency in our state for a number of years for COVID. That is over. So we no longer have a state of emergency for COVID. However, there are other circumstances, the most notably being wildfires, where the governor will at times proclaim a state of emergency in the state. What this does is it allows, in the time that there's any proclaimed state of emergency, not just for COVID, but for any reason, it allows you to appear remotely only during a proclaimed state of emergency. So its usefulness is not necessarily that helpful, but it's better than nothing. It does give a tinge more flexibility, but only during this proclaimed state of emergency time.
Excuse me, is it appropriate to ask a question now, or would you rather have us wait?
I would love you to ask a question now.
Okay, I might have missed it. You ran ahead a little bit. All right. In the past, we've had scheduled board meetings. Of course, we have scheduled board meetings now. But because an authorizer sometimes requests, actually, it's only one occasion, where the authorizer requests that certain financial documents be approved by the board before they're submitted. And the day of when that happens is a moving target. You know, when you get the specific information that you need from the state, several different variables may cause you to try to come up with a date where it reconciles and the board can approve it, these financial documents, before you submit it. But you can't always tell when you're at the beginning of the year setting the meetings for the whole year. Therefore, we're required to set up these special meetings, short special meetings, in order to get some document approved. And I might add that it creates a lot of stress on the financial department because they have to hurry up and go in order to get it approved within enough time for the board to approve it. In the past, we've had a delegation, it's been delegated, where the board would delegate the CEO or the superintendent to approve the document, and then they would ratify it at their next regular meeting. Is there a law which requires that we have these special meetings in order to get documents approved before submitting them to the state and the county and the district? Or is that just a local request? And if it is a local request, is it one that we need to adhere to? Because it's the difference between having 3 or 4 board meetings or 8.
There's no requirement in the law that you need to do that. In terms of adhering to it, that's going to depend on your relationship with your authorizer and whether this is a battle you want to fight with them.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to move on from teleconferencing, but let me know if you have any questions from that. This isn't, like I said, it's the area where we get the most questions. And so, you know, it's very confusing. It is frustrating given that boards are able to participate remotely and can often engage more and more often if they're allowed to do so. So it's frustrating that the law has not caught up to this new world and this new reality. All right. But our next topic is, what are meeting notice and agenda requirements? So golden rule is that with limited exceptions, if it's not on the agenda, the board must not discuss it. This bears on transparency, the sunshiny requirements of the Brown Act, the technical rule we've just written out here so that you know it, the agenda has to be posted in advance of a meeting and must include a brief description of items to be transacted or discussed. And brief means brief. You know, essentially you want the public to be able to know what you're talking about, but they don't have to know, you know, it doesn't need to be a paragraph. It can be 20 words. Now, there are some limited exceptions to when the board can discuss a non-agenda item. They are very rare because, of course, they are not, you know, Brown Act is all about transparency. So discussing something that's not on the agenda doesn't accord with that transparency requirement. But there are these limited exceptions. The first is emergency situations. This is a determination by a majority vote of the board that an emergency or a dire emergency exists. This is extremely rare. This is a public health crisis. This is something where the school needs to be shut down. This is something where it is incredibly important that the board discuss it. They have to discuss it. There's not enough time to post on the agenda, and there's not even enough time to hold a special emergency meeting, which we'll talk about a little later. It's very, very rare that that would be the case. Number two is continued matters. So if the agenda was posted for a prior meeting and that meeting occurred not more than 5 calendar days before the date on which the action was taken, and at the prior meeting, the board said, okay, we're going to table this, we're going to continue this to next meeting, then technically the board does not have to re-put that on the agenda. They could just discuss it. However, best practice would be if you know you were going to discuss it at the next meeting, put it on the agenda so that you don't raise any questions. Also, some exceptions to discussing a matter not on the agenda, a quick direction to staff. If something comes up and you've made a decision about how a certain agendized item should go, you can, of course, give a quick notice to staff about what you would like them to do, tell your administration how you would like them to handle XYZ. You can also give very brief responses, clarifying questions, brief announcements. Or you can also identify future agenda items. This is something that we see actually with the most frequency in terms of these. You'll have a community member or a parent come to a board meeting and say, this happened with my student. I want the board to agendize it. And should the board want to do that, they can quickly note to the administration that they would like this item on the future agenda. Okay, but for all of those, just think very rare, with the exception of the last one, which I do see with some frequency. But generally, if it's not on the agenda, we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to discuss it. Quick point on board interaction with the public on agenda items. So these are items that are on the agenda. This problems with this usually occur when the item is causing a lot of community or familial stress. And there's a lot of members of the public there, a lot of people with opinions and who want to share their insights with the board, some of which might be hard to hear if it's a stressful issue and the emotions are high. And so where I have seen boards get into trouble the most is where a family member or a parent or a guardian says something that is in the board member's mind, unfair to the school or unfair to the staff. And the board member might be prompted to respond to defend their administration or to defend their teachers. Doing so is potentially problematic. You can briefly interact with the public on agenda items beyond just receiving the input. However, it can just lead to a host of issues. If you get into a back and forth, a couple of years ago, I was in a board meeting. There's a very, very antagonistic family member who was there. The board member who they were speaking to predominantly was engaging in this back and forth conversation with them. And it's just, it's really not best practice to do so. For a variety of reasons, on this slide, we have a number of risks that are attendant to that extensive interaction. You risk it veering into topics that are not agendized, not in the agenda. And as we know, we can't talk about those. There's also just this risk of inefficient, chaotic, long meetings. If you engage in this back and forth, it's generally not productive. Nobody in that space is going to find the resolution or the result that they're looking for. And so it just adds a lot of stress and unnecessary chaos to the meetings. It also creates a risk of board indecision if you start veering into other territories. You know, the board might no longer be aligned if other things come up that weren't agendized. A risk of violations of board policies on complaints. Most schools have a formal complaint practice, like a uniform complaint procedure or just other complaint procedures. And if you are hearing from the public too much on XYZ, it may risk not following those procedures that are already set in place by the school. And then there's also a violation of due process. So if a parent is coming to a board meeting and is talking with a member of personnel, they might have due process rights that are violated with extensive engaging with that parent over that particular staff member. Okay, agenda posting requirements. So regular meetings, I know that you all know these. The agenda has to be posted 72 hours in advance. Special meetings, 24 hours in advance, and emergency meetings, at least 1 hour. These are exceptionally rare, dire circumstances, crippling disaster, mass destruction, terrorist activity. Think about it as something that severely impacts public health, public safety, or both, to the point where you can't wait even 24 hours to do a special meeting. The allowance, though, for this emergency meeting and having it be only 1 hour in advance really makes the necessity of having to talk about emergency non-agenda items pretty much nil in my mind. Because if you're going to, if there's an emergency and you're holding this emergency meeting, again, these are exceptionally rare, you have to give 1 hour advance notice. That's fine in these circumstances, but you wouldn't typically need to do it sooner than an hour. You wouldn't typically need to pull the board together sooner than an hour and discuss an emergency that's a non-agenda item, if that makes sense, because you do have this allowance under the emergency meetings. However, these are both very, very rare. It's really these incredibly special circumstances. Where must the agenda be posted? So it has to be physically posted in a publicly accessible place for that entire posting period. Within its jurisdiction, that includes all teleconferencing locations and all school sites and resource centers, if applicable. If the charter school maintains a website, which virtually every charter school does now, the agenda has to also be posted on that website. And then on the website's homepage, with a prominent direct link, the current agenda has to appear. The agenda must be downloadable and searchable, and it has to be free access, meaning you can't have it behind a, even not a paywall, but even, you know, you can't have to log in. Whenever I'm giving Brown Act trainings, I go to the school's website and I check to make sure that they do have this prominent direct link on their homepage. And I'm happy to report that you all do. So we are all good there. Okay, how must closed sessions be agendized and processed? All right, so now we're getting into the closed sessions. We've mentioned these a couple times. There are six reasons why the charter school can meet in closed session for purposes of discussing certain things that the public should not or cannot be allowed to. The default rule is, of course, we always talk about what we can in open session, unless the legislator has provided this very specific exception that allows you to meet in closed session. When you do meet in closed session, we have a few tips here. Use the safe harbor language. So in the Brown Act itself, there is language that you can use for every closed session with the exception of pupil discipline. So we call it safe harbor because the legislator has essentially said, if you use our language and you fill in the blanks, then people can't challenge you. They cannot say that your agenda item is insufficient. The board chair also has to provide oral notice in advance of closed session. And the board must make public a public report of every reportable action taken in closed session and the roll call vote or abstention of every member to the extent that that's applicable. If you go into closed session and no action is taken, that's fine, that happens often. You would just come out of closed session and say no action was taken. Okay, a quick note on executive compensation. We added this fairly recently because we saw a number of schools having issues with this. So the legislator has determined that approval of CEO, executive director, and department heads' compensation have to occur at a regular, not a special meeting. And more than that, prior to final action, the board must orally report a summary of the recommendation for final action, including all the details. So the salary schedule to the extent that that's applicable, any fringe benefit, all of that has to be orally reported during open session, in open session, where the final action will be taken. The final action also has to be taken in open session. Where we see this trip people up the most is most schools know that that's true of their CEO or and their president. Most schools do not know that that is also true of any department heads that they have. So executive directors, some schools know, but department heads, that trips up a lot. So you have to take, that all has to be public. So it has to be out in the open, their full salary, all of their information. About the benefits that they're getting, have to be regular meeting, have to be during open session, and then the final action has to be an open session. So it's very, it's the reason is to shine a bright light on salaries, ensure the compensation is fair, not wildly out of proportion with their responsibilities, but it can be onerous, particularly for larger schools that may have a number of department heads, because it has to be at a regular, not a special meeting. All right, the public and their rights. Okay. The first is the right to provide public testimony. And we are going to discuss today addressing disruptive speakers. Two, taping or broadcasting, they have a right to do that. There can be no conditions on attendance. So this has not happened for a long, long time. But at one point, there were some schools that were requiring like a driver's license in order to attend the meeting. That's absolutely not acceptable. Non-discriminatory facilities, that usually comes up in terms of ADA compliance. They are also to be given copies of agendas and any other public writings that are going to be available. And for a public speaker who has to use an interpreter, you have to give double the time. So if you generally allow 2 minutes for public comment, for somebody who uses an interpreter, you would have to give 4 minutes to ensure that they have equal opportunity, because of course their interpreter would be taking some of that time. Okay, there is this new law. It just came into effect in January of this year. It adds a section to the Brown Act authorizing the board chair or designee of the board chair to remove or cause the removal of an individual who is disrupting the meeting. Disrupting is defined helpfully. So it means engaging in behavior during a meeting of a legislative body that actually is disruptive. It's disturbing, it's impeding, it's rendering infeasible the orderly conduct of the meeting. They do give us a couple of examples. The first one is failure to comply with reasonable and lawful regulations or policies related to public comments. So if somebody will not stop talking, and you have warned them and you have told them that they have exceeded their time and that they need to sit down, and they will not stop. I've seen that happen at one meeting that was in person. That would be a situation where you potentially could remove them if it's really, truly impacting your ability to continue the meeting. The second one is more obvious. This is an area where you absolutely would want to exercise this. If an individual is engaging in a behavior that constitutes use of force or a threat of force, there you would want to remove that individual or cause that individual to be removed. Before removing the individual, if they're in the case where it's not the true threat of force, if that's the case, you do not have to warn them. But if you're in the other circumstance where they're just being incredibly disruptive and you cannot continue the meeting, you have to warn them. You have to say that they're disrupting the meeting, and you need to say your failure to stop disrupting this meeting will result in your removal. So you have to give them this warning ahead of time. After you give that warning, if they still are disrupting the meeting to the point where you literally cannot carry on, then you can remove them or cause them to be removed. We caution you against doing this yourself. It can just lead, first, we don't want anybody, you all, to get hurt. But second, it can just lead to other liability issues. We recommend calling the police and having the police come, the local police generally, and remove the individual. Or if you have security, that would be fine too. The warning requirement, as I said, it does not apply to a behavior constituting a true threat of force. So a true threat of force is a sufficient indicia of intent and seriousness. A reasonable observer would basically look at the person and perceive that there is an actual threat there. The person's making a threat, and you as a board looking at that would think, okay, this person is being serious. This is an actual threat. Then you do not have to warn them. You can cause a removal immediately. All right, we're getting back into the land of closed sessions. So authorized closed sessions include the following: personnel, with the caveat that 24-hour written notice has to be given to an employee if complaints or charges against that employer are going to be heard. Real estate negotiations, labor negotiations, conference with legal counsel, public security issues, pupil discipline. These are all areas where you can go in and you can go into closed session, and the public is not allowed access when discussing these. Personnel is really broad. So it's this is just the statutory language. It's appointment, evaluation, discipline, dismissal, or release of an employee. So to the extent that you're discussing any of those, that's when you can go into closed session. On most of these, you'll see a common theme. So like personnel, pupil discipline, those you're allowed to go into closed session to discuss to protect privacy. People have a right to privacy, and going into closed session protects that right. We also see some of these things like real estate negotiations, labor negotiations, about getting the best deal for the taxpayer, not wanting to show your hand, not wanting the other side to be able to see what your best and final is before you're ready to show that to them. Confidentiality. So no one who is in closed session, no board member, staff member, or other invitee can disclose any information from the closed session without explicit authorization of the board. What happens in closed session stays in closed session. Nobody else can know. All right, we are moving on to penalties and remedies for violating the Brown Act. One important thing to know is that if a violation is found, a court can come in and can null and void the entire board action. There's also that, so, you know, there's also injunctive relief that can be obtained, and the prevailing party can get attorney's fees. So this is why we work really hard with schools if and when they do get a Brown Act violation notice, to cure that violation so that the charter school ultimately does not get sued, because attorney fees and this can quickly become quite expensive. Criminal penalties can also apply. If there's a level of intent there, or there was an intent to deceive the public, we don't see that happen too often. The only time that I have seen this is when the district attorney is already looking into the charter school for something else. If they're also violating the Brown Act, they might throw that into the mix. But I have not seen any DAs being interested in pursuing that just for the violation itself. There's also the risk of potential charter revocation, because compliance with the laws is an area required of all charters. And so to the extent that you are violating the Brown Act, you are violating the law, and that can lead you down the road of revocation. And then stakeholder trust can be harmed as well. You know, the Brown Act is all about transparency. And so, you know, to the extent that the public thinks that people are not operating openly or not operating transparently, they can lose trust. So there's a notice and demand for cure process in the event that there is a Brown Act violation. So generally written demand for an alleged open session violations have to be made within 30 days. Otherwise, demands have to be made within 90 days. Then the board has 30 days to notify the demanding party that it will or will not cure. And then the demanding party can initiate litigation after that point. And as we discussed, if that's successful, they can be awarded attorney fees. So the bottom line here is, if the demand, I had a client come to us a few months ago with a Brown Act violation, but it had been more than 90 days. There is no, at that point, it's cleared. The demand for a Brown Act violation has to be made within 90 days. However, you know, of course, we try to avoid these at all costs generally because they're expensive and for all the other reasons that we discussed. Okay, that is the Brown Act training. We're going to move on now to conflict of interest, but I wanted to just pause for a second to answer any questions about Brown Act that you all might have. And if not, I'll just go straight into conflict of interest, but I wanted to give you all a second. All right, hearing none, we'll move on. Okay, conflicts of interest. We have this broad definition. What is a conflict of interest? It arises when an individual who has a private financial interest in the outcome of a corporate contract or public decision participates, again, this is underlined because this is the statutory language, participates in the decision-making process or influences or attempts to influence others making the contract or decision. So in short, there's this clash between an individual's duty to his or her office and his or her personal interests outside of that. We see this arise anytime, we see this arise most often when there's a situation where you have some sort of private financial situation, things like contracts for goods, if you work at a company who provides said goods, a contract for services. In either event, you would have a circumstance where that board member or that employee then proceeds to participate in those discussions. That's when we run into conflict of interest issues. That's when it's problematic. And I want to note here, just for, you know, we just came off the Brown Act training, but this is not, the conflict of interest stuff is not only at the board meeting, of course. It's also, think about like the earliest planning and discussion that might occur before the board and the staff, or between the board and staff, relating to that contract that ultimately gets entered into. So it's basically any time, as we've said here, the board influences or attempts to, or employee influences or attempts to influence any decision, any contract that's going to financially benefit them. So it's very broad, and we have seen that become an issue. Common types of financial interest regulated by conflict of interest. Again, this is broad. Ownership or investment in a business entity, investment in real property, anything that's your source of income, source of gift. Gifts are a huge thing under conflict of interest laws. We have a couple of slides dedicated to them exclusively, and effect on personal finances. So one thing to note here is it's financial interest of immediate family members, of board members and employees are covered. So it's not just your own financial interest, but also the financial interest of your immediate family members. Okay, so first, as we do this conflict of interest analysis, we do it in steps. We start with the absolutely most stringent law, and then we go all the way to common law and all of the different violations that can follow in those. But the most stringent law for conflict of interest purposes is Government Code Section 1090. A violation of this is a felony in the state of California, and there have been charter school board members who have been successfully prosecuted under this statute. So it arises anytime you have a public official, officer, board member, employee, making a public contract, and that contract is for sale or for purchase, when the public official has this financial interest in the contract. When these things are the case, if it is a board member, the board is faced with an absolute bar to entering into that contract. Unless there is an exception that otherwise applies, because there are some exceptions. If it's an employee, it can be a little bit different in that they may be able, depending on the circumstance, to refrain from participating in discussion. They may be able to fully recuse themselves, meaning the contract could go forward. We'll discuss that. But generally, you know, best practice would be to try to avoid anything to that end. You know, even the appearance of impropriety could arise in that situation. Okay, this is what we need to know about Section 1090. If the board member has a financial interest, the entire board is prohibited from entering into that contract. This is the case even if the person, the contract would be the best vendor. Even if it's the best price, even if it's the lowest price, and even if that interested board member abstains. So unless a small exception applies, that's incredibly broad, and it is incredibly important because some boards will get into this and think, well, but this is the lowest price and this board member didn't participate in any of the discussion. That does not matter. If there's any financial interest, it's prohibited. And making a public contract is defined very broadly, as I mentioned on the last slide. It applies to the earliest discussions, the planning process, of course, the solicitation for bids, not just the ultimate vote. So it really applies from the outset. Thus, the statute's in most respects the toughest standard to meet. As I said, we're going to kind of go through a three-part analysis of whether something constitutes a conflict of interest. This one's the most stringent because it is broad and because it is very serious. It's a felonious act and the contract is void. Okay, Political Reform Act. Before we delve into this, I really just want to make it clear that we only get into the analysis of the Political Reform Act if there was an exception to Government Code 1090. So if there's an exception to Government Code 1090, generally we see that be with employees. It's very detailed so that we would want to discuss that on like a fact-to-fact basis. But if there is an exception to Government Code 90 and that applied, then we would go into Political Reform Act. If there's, of course, no exception to 1090, we stop there, full stop. We're not entering into that contract at all. We're only looking at Political Reform Act if we've passed through the 1090, there's an exception, and then we need to see if it's problematic under this act. Okay, the big picture for a Political Reform Act is that it's a public official participating in or attempting to influence a governmental decision. That public official has a qualifying financial interest, which qualifying does include, of course, themselves, but also their spouse, their partner, their children. The financial interest is material. So this is, less stringent than we saw under 1090. This is not just any financial interest. This is a material financial interest. The official must recuse themselves. So this under 1090, it did not matter if it was any modicum of financial interest. That was absolutely not acceptable. You cannot apply for that. You cannot engage in that contract. You certainly cannot accept that contract, even if they recuse themselves. Under the Political Reform Act, they can. So if the official is able to recuse themselves from all parts of the decision-making process from the outset, then potentially you can enter into that contract. There's lots of very detailed regulations that have been adopted by the FPPC. So again, this is for both 1090 and the Political Reform Act. To the extent that there are any questions, it's very fact intensive. And so we recommend chatting with us about, whether these exceptions would apply and then whether, to the extent that you do want to enter into that contract, whether you can. Okay, then we also have the Conflict of Interest Code. This is also under the Political Reform Act. So that states who must file the Form 700 and it assigns disclosure categories under that. All right, so the Form 700, all board members need to fill out a Form 700. It's a statement of economic interest. There are very clear deadlines on when it has to be followed. It's when somebody's assuming or reappointing position, then it has to be filed within 30 days. And then after that, once annually by April 1st. You also have to file it again upon leaving. So to the extent that a board member resigns or is otherwise removed from the board, within 30 days, they have to file a Form 700. There are penalties for failure to file, criminal charges and a civil administrative action by the FPPC. Or a private citizen. There's a law that essentially allows a private citizen to bring a charge for against you under this circumstance, should they know that you have failed to follow this. Okay, financial interest for Form 700. It's investment, it's very broad. Investment of business entity of 2000 or more, real property investment of 2000 or more, income of 500 or more, business position and entity, so if you are in working at an entity, and gift of $50 or more. The gift thing is really, really intense in what it gets most, what it gets some schools, because it is such a low dollar amount. Okay, check the Conflict of Interest Code to determine what you must report. So typically you have to report all your financial interests. However, you do not have to report your residence and you do not have to report your income from a public agency. You do have to report half of your spouse's income, as well as any financial interest within your jurisdiction. So it's very invasive. Property within 2 miles of your jurisdiction, investments or businesses in your jurisdiction, and gifts, all gifts inside or outside of your jurisdiction. All of that has to be reported. All of that has to be disclosed. Okay, gifts. The general rule is that you cannot accept more than $590 from one source in a calendar year. This just went up about $50 in January. It's still a very low dollar amount. The other general rule is that gifts worth more than 50, so the first rule is you cannot accept them. The second rule is if they are worth more than 50, they have to be reported. And that's one gift or aggregate gifts. So if you get a few gifts that are equal $50, then you have to report that. However, there are many exceptions to both of those rules, the most common being special occasions, birthdays, holidays. You can get gifts from anyone if the gift giving and taking is proportional. So you're giving a gift on their birthday, you get a gift from them on their birthday. That's fine, unless they're a lobbyist. For all of these, if they're a lobbyist, they cannot give you gifts, even if you have a special relationship with them. The second one is inheritance. Number three is family members. So again, this makes sense. But again, if you have a lobbyist family member, you cannot give and you cannot get gifts from them. So family members is defined very broadly, as you can see there. We also have long-term friendships. If you have been friends for a period of time, that period is not defined, but you have a substantial friendship and you all give gifts on occasion, even outside of holidays or birthdays. As long as they're not a lobbyist and as long as you both give and take, then that's fine. And then again, if you're dating, you're in a bona fide relationship, again, that's not defined, then as long as they're not a lobbyist, you can get gifts. Okay, prohibition against conflicts of interest. So now we're in the common law conflicts of interest. So it started with the 1090. Then if you pass the Public Reform Act, the PRA, then you go down to common law conflicts of interest to see if there's any prohibition in this category. The prohibition against conflicts of interest, it's public officials engaging in transactions or influencing a decision that creates an appearance of impropriety. Financial interest is not necessarily required here, although often it's implicated. There's also this doctrine of incompatible offices. So a public official cannot hold two offices simultaneously. That would be a violation of common law conflict of interest because then they would have these divided loyalties if the offices are incompatible with each other and are in overlapping jurisdiction. Okay, we do have a new law, another one. It's an ethics training requirement. So existing law required members and certain employees of cities and counties to engage in 2 hours of ethics training that was relevant to their public service every 2 years. So AB 2158 essentially just adds requirements to add charter schools to the list of this requirement. It says that charter schools also have to fulfill this requirement, the charter school boards. Now, a lot of, when I've given this training over the past few months, one question that has come up is what about employees? There's no requirement in the law that the employees have to also have this ethics training. That said, to the extent it's feasible for the employees, I think that it would be a good practice and would be, you know, look good to the authorizers and the outside world, especially if it's already happening in a board meeting where the employee would be attending anyway. This was signed by the governor last year. It just became effective this year, but it doesn't actually ramp up. Full compliance is not needed until January of 2026. So there are specific requirements under this. So I'll get into those, but it essentially allows everybody time to get these scheduled, get these done, and then you know, ramp up to full compliance. Okay, ethics laws is defined. It's pretty broad. So it's laws relating to personal financial gain by public servants, including laws prohibiting bribery and conflict of interest laws. Laws relating to claiming perquisites of office, including but not limited to gift and travel restrictions, prohibition against the use of public resources for personal or political uses, prohibition against gift of public funds, mass mailing restrictions, other prohibitions on various things. So they do give you some ideas of the topics that can can be part of your ethics laws. However, it's not an inclusive list. So if there's something that you feel as a board would be particularly helpful or valuable to your school, and it could follow under this, you know, ethics laws broadly, then that would likely be fine. There are some particular requirements. The FPPC and the AG must be consulted in connection with the development of course materials, which is an incredibly strange requirement from my perspective, because all of these schools are going to be doing all of their ethics, different ethics training. And so having to consult with these entities just makes the requirement more onerous. We will be developing these trainings broadly, and then to the extent that schools want them, we'll of course be tailoring them as well. But when we do develop the trainings, we'll make sure that they are in full compliance, meaning that the FPPC and the AG have been consulted. Charter schools must provide their officials with information on how they can meet these training requirements at least once annually. And then you have to maintain records. So for at least 5 years after the training's done, you have to indicate the dates that the official satisfied those training requirements and the entities or entity that provided that training. So you have to keep records, you know, that's just in case it's audited, so that you can ensure that you show that you have in fact completed this. Applicability, I mentioned this at the beginning, So this is actually the applicability of to board members themselves. So it's not applicable to board members whose terms will expire before January 1st, 2026, because that's when the ramp up period, that's when full compliance is required. So if your term expires before then and your term is not being renewed, then you would not have to follow this. All other board members seated as of January 1st, 2025, must receive the required training by January 1st, 2026 and do retraining every 2 years after that. So I think what a number of our schools are going to do is add this ethics training on to their General Brown Act and their General Conflict of Interest training, get it all done in one go. Okay, so that is all on conflict of interest. Happy to answer any questions. On the 13th, when Paul and I rejoin you, Paul is going to be discussing these next slides, the roles and responsibilities of the board and the administration. And then we'll delve into some interesting cases. We've seen a lot of First Amendment cases over the last year about freedom of religion, freedom of expression. And so, you know, we have some interesting updates for you there. But for conflict of interest and Brown Act, that is all from me today. So I am happy to answer any questions you all have. All right, if there are none, Admiral Herring, I will turn it back over to you to close out the meeting.
Okay, thank you very much. Very informative. I'll probably have an opportunity to think some of this stuff out and maybe have a session in the next go around where we can maybe come back and ask a couple questions on items that you brought up.
Oh, that's an absolutely excellent idea.
Yeah. Just there's a lot there, and there's some questions that individuals may want to ask.
Sure.
Thinking about them next time. So if you would please, as the training provides, place that on the agenda. Before we start the second session, then if there are no questions or anything for you, then we'll just proceed with the second half of the training during the next session. Okay. So I want to thank you very much for your time this morning and the clarity of the training. There's a lot there. And we definitely appreciate you providing that for us. Keeping us earnest is always good. It's better to be informed than trying to figure out how to get out from underneath a mistake that you probably should not have made. So going forward, the next section is 4.0, which is board announcements and comments. I will say that the first one of importance is just a reminder for everybody that we do have part two of the board workshop and best practices in charter schools management, including fiduciary and the Brown Act. Conflict of interest laws and critical case updates for new laws affecting charter schools. And that training will be held on Monday, November the 13th, between 8 and 9 a.m. And if you've not, I'm sure that Angela will provide everybody an update so that the Zoom is current. Okay. Any other comments by any of the other board members?
Just a thank you for a very thorough explanation of everything that we're responsible for. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you all.
Okay, then moving on is item 5.0, which is the adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved, Barton.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second, Morton.
Very good. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll move on to roll call for abstention, for adjournment. Myself, aye. Scott?
Aye.
David is excused. Tim?
Aye.
And Eric?
Aye.
Motion passes. I want to thank everybody for their time, and more importantly, the Paul and Company for their training and advice this morning. We do really do appreciate it. Keeping us, again, earnest and informed is very important for the board to be ready and able to assist the organization wherever we can. Okay, so everybody stay good.
All right. Thanks, Kayla. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.